I don't know what's real. I don't know what's not real.
Limited Capacity is a collection of six darkly amusing stories about the mysterious ways we interact with the internet and with each other.
There's something going on with him. It's like an act. I don't trust him.
What?
You're staring at me like I should say something, but I don't really know what to do here.
That's the whole name of the game. Don't talk about how the town isn't real. Do you understand?
Limited Capacity. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
The name is the pronunciation of your last name? The name?
Yeah. Maybe.
All right. Well, this is going to be fun. We are talking to another author. And this time, a book about mental health. But a little bit of a different spin on it compared to what we talked about with our friend Donna a few weeks back. Sabrina Benim.
Benim.
Wow.
Yeah.
Considering, you literally said your name.
Considering you just
2 minutes ago?
Cleared it up and you were like, sweet, got it.
Got it. I'm going to blame it on the CF. Sabrina Benim, your book, I Love You, Call Me Back, is available now, considering when this comes out, on sale October 19th. And we are really glad to have you here in the studio via Zoom. But why don't you take a moment to give our listeners a bit of an introduction into who you are and where the book sort of stems from, because it's not just a book, it's a book of poetry, correct?
Right. Yeah. So I'm Sabrina. I want to say like 7 years ago now, I got into Poetry Slam because I had a tumor in my throat that everybody joked was like me swallowing all my feelings, because I always secretly wrote and never shared anything. So I got into sharing and I had a poem go viral called Explaining My Depression to My Mother. So that's kind of what's got me talking about mental health and stuff like that. And then this collection specifically stems from a lot of things. It stems from loneliness. It stems from dealing with a diagnosis that my mom got that was really heavy for us as a family and had a lot of uncertainty. It stems from, I guess, pandemic times. I have to say that it's written from a standpoint of like this world that's unfathomable outside, and you kind of are stuck with yourself and have to deal with that. And for me, that of course looks at mental illness. So that's kind of who I am. I write a lot about that. I'm looking at stigma and saying like, no, thank you. So that's kind of my vibe. Yeah.
No, thank you. I think that's a great episode title right there. Stigma. No, thank you. Can we just take it back a little bit? Was this a metaphor, a tumor in your throat, or did you legit have a tumor in your throat?
I legit had a tumor, yeah. It came out in 2013.
What was it? Was it a benign tumor?
It was benign, and it was the size of a squash ball right in the middle of my throat. Like it literally looked like I had an Adam's apple.
Whoa.
Oh my God.
Why do they always use ball analogies when they talk about
because
the size of tumors?
Shaped more or less that way.
I mean, that would be my guess.
Is it because like there's like standards to certain size balls? So like if you get a squash ball, you know exactly how big it is. If you get like a basketball, you know exactly how big it is.
I think so.
Like every time we hear somebody talk about a tumor, they're like, it was the size of name the ball.
Yeah. And it's like when if you're pregnant, it's like, you know, it's week 10. Your baby is the size of a kiwi.
That's kind
and then
of
it's like yeah, and then it's like an orange, and then it's like a squash, and then it's like, you know,
they should use balls though instead of fruits and vegetables, because balls are more like they're always the exact same size, right? You know, like
I guess
like,
so.
There's a lot of variables.
Let's make a stand.
There should be a standard ball description.
Change the way they describe the size of children who are growing in stomachs. to the same we use for tumors.
Okay, yes, bringing it back. So Sabrina,
sorry, Sabrina.
How did you? Can we talk about the tumor for just a little bit? Is that, you know, obviously, I mean, I don't want to beat this ball thing to death, but a squash ball in your throat, pretty substantial size ball. Is that something that, like, did you start to notice it over time as it was getting bigger and bigger, like to that standard squash ball size, or was it just kind of one day you woke up and you're like, what the fuck is going on with my throat?
Yeah. So squash ball is like about the diameter of my pinky finger, just for reference. And
that's the standard.
And yeah, no, it actually was like this weird party trick where I'd be like, yo, like feel my throat. If I swallow it, it's like this thing is inside of it. It's crazy. And everyone was like, that's not check that out. And so, yeah, I definitely felt it when I swallowed and stuff like that as it grew. So I went and got it checked out because I felt it. Yeah.
And the removal was like, I take it was surgery or?
Yeah, it was really simple. Actually, when I found out about it, the doctor came in with like a headlamp and I was like, oh, this is not a good energy for me. And he just came in and was like, well, we're just going to take it right out and then you're going to go about your day. Mm. I was like, oh,
cool. Okay. Wow. Very simple. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
It was really simple.
Considering the simplicity of that, did that experience play into your like mental health journey at all? Like, was there, you know, like, do you look back on that experience and see how that played a role in your in struggling with your mental health, or was that just a completely separate thing that that ties into like getting into the slam poetry?
I think that more ties into me like sharing my work than it does my mental health, just because. I don't know. It wasn't so much, it was more this idea of like, oh, maybe I did do this to myself. Like if it's not malignant, if it's not, you know, like why is it here? The doctors couldn't explain why I got this tumor. And I was like, maybe it really was because I held everything in for so long. And so it kind of made me reexamine that aspect of my life.
So going back further than that, obviously we know, you know, we've already mentioned it. You're a published poet. what kind of shape did your writing take, the writing that you weren't sharing, like how, what, like where did that, where was that fostered? Was it something that you just kind of, that was just something that you enjoyed doing in your free time? What was it, something that you were like passionate about, but you know, you had a fear around sharing it? What was that, how did that grow and take shape up until you get the tumor and decide to start sharing it?
I think a lot of it is just navigating. Like I obviously have had depression and anxiety for a long time. And I think before I was diagnosed, a lot of it was just me navigating it through writing, trying to figure out like, are these feelings normal? Is this, how do I even feel? And like, what's going on with me? And so writing really took that on for me. It was very therapeutic throughout like high school, I would say. And then it wasn't until my like later teen years, early 20s, where I really like started crafting things where I was like, okay, I'm going to write pieces or I'm going to put together a collection. And I really did it secretly. Like I really didn't share it, but I was always working on something. Mm-hmm.
Did it make you feel like when you wrote something down in the context of you saying that you were kind of like exploring how you were feeling and whether that was, you know, norm, quote unquote normal, and navigating, you know, depression and anxiety, did it make you feel like you could look at your writing and go and sort of see it from like a, almost like a bird's eye view of yourself? Like, I feel like that when I read old stuff of mine, like I'm almost like, that's a different person and I'm observing that person.
Absolutely. And, or sometimes you're like, oh, that's how I feel about that thing. Like I did not know that until I wrote this line and, realized it. So yeah,
it's such a feeling. It's very hard to it's easy to describe in the way that like you're looking kind of like objectively looking at yourself, but it's such a weird feeling to look at something that you've written and think, that's a different person, but it's the same person.
Sometimes,
or a different version of you.
Sometimes it's scary too. Like I started taking a visual journaling class a couple weeks ago, and I've been sketching a lot and like sort of putting words to sketches and really just sort of like using it as like my own sort of meditation to, you know, connect with some of my deeper thoughts that live within my head. And I go to therapy too, and so I talk about a lot of these things with my therapist, but I find that journaling sometimes for me can be really scary, because it's sort of like once I write something down on the page, it also feels kind of real, because it no longer just lives in my head. It now exists like in reality as well. And Sabrina, I'm kind of I'm interested to know, for you, like it, like what has that experience been like? You know, sort of, because I think people are under the impression that sometimes it's easier to write down your thoughts to sort of get them out, but I find personally that it can be scary. What's that experience been like for you?
Yeah, it's especially for this collection, like thinking about what my mom was going through, like having to sit down and be like, okay, I'm gonna write how I feel about what will happen if my mom might die. Like, that's terrifying. Yeah. I don't want to even think about that, let alone, you know, work through it and craft it into a piece. But it feels almost like that fear of it is kind of what motivates me. Like, that's the urgency, that fear of getting it onto the page. And mm-hmm. once it's real, once it's on the page, I can kind of craft it into a different story if I want. So like, for example, a lot of the love relationship in this collection is like many relationships amalgamated into this one narrative. So I don't give too much away of my personal life, but also it's there. It's compelling.
I mean, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what it's about. Yeah. I have this like weird feeling of like when I write something down, that even if I write it for myself, like somebody else will read it. But like the interesting thing is that you're writing this down with the intent that somebody else is going to read it. So how does that play into how you share those details?
I don't think about that at all. The first couple drafts are solely for me. Like, I don't even think about sharing the poem until it's in like the third draft. And I'm like, okay, is this, what is this? Is it shareable? Or is this like a journal entry that I just needed to kind of get out and work through myself?
How did you feel about the first time that you shared anything that you wrote? Like, did you know, like, okay, this is the piece, this feels ready to be given to the world? Or did that experience come with like a whole host full of self-doubt before, you know, stepping in front of an audience and actually sharing it?
So this is really embarrassing to admit, but in high school, I used to post my poetry on a dashboard confessional like website board.
Fuck yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, so, like a band tribute?
No. Yeah, no. They had like a board, a messaging board, right, that you could like share work, and I would just like secretly post poems on there. Like anonymously. I had like a really weird screen name, and it was just, like that's what I did. And so I think I always wanted to share it, because there's this thing in the back of your mind where you're like, am I a genius? You know, like that, like you write a line and you're like, this is really good. I don't know. I just need one other person to tell me it might be. And so I always kind of wanted to share it, but I never wanted to share it as myself. So the first time I started sharing as myself, it was this weird relief, actually, where it felt like, oh, I can do this and integrate all of these selves into one. That's
probably the perfect place to like be vulnerable with a group of people. I just feel like the dashboard confessional listener community is probably like a very supportive and like kind group of people. I was listening to Dashboard the other day while I was driving. It was really nice.
I haven't listened to Dashboard confessional in a very long time.
It's so it's emotional.
Yeah, definitely brings me back to an older time, a younger time. Go for it,
Jeff. The book, I Love You, Call Me Back, you touch on, and we've sort of touched on this, but you touch on a lot of like universal experiences, the loss of a relationship, the loneliness that comes with isolation that I think a lot of us have experienced a lot of over the last year and a half. And also the anxiety of caring for a loved one from afar, who's dealing with a serious diagnosis. Was it your mother that had come down with a diagnosis of some sort?
Yeah, my mom has a very large aortic aneurysm.
Oh, wow. And the process of writing about these things that are so universal, what is your process for diving into that kind of territory? You know, I feel like you kind of touched on it when you were talking to Brian there a moment ago, but like you're writing this poetry based on your own personal experience, but is there a point where the writing process starts to shift or evolve based on what you're reading to sort of like relate to a more general audience, or is it really just fully personal, knowing that we all go through these experiences in life and there's going to be something that's gleaned from it regardless of who you are?
So I think I have two answers to that. Kind of the first is, yeah, like I think the more specific you can be, the kind of more you go into the universal. In a weird way, in writing, it kind of works like that for me. So if I can be really specific and pinpoint something, it tends to kind of hit the nerve on the bigger picture, which I like. And then the flip of that is, yeah, I definitely add in details in the editing process to make it a little bit more relatable. Like I did not bake any bread last year, but there is a comment about baking bread in the book because that's what everyone else was doing, you know.
That's great.
Everyone found their love of fostering a culture.
Yeah.
What's it called?
I have a horrible joke I make all the time where it was just like everyone was baking bread and I was just getting baked.
Yeah. I mean, it's like just it was like same thing. What's it called? Where the two words have the same meaning? Not an antonym?
Is it an antonym? Homonym?
Homonym.
Homonym, where the same word has the same meaning or a different meaning. Like, what was. Like there's something about there's something that is emerging now, and I would say that your work slots into this category of, you know, work that has come from like a very, even though we are collectively all going through the pandemic and all the, you know, the waves and the lockdowns and then the restrictions easing and then the lockdowns, or in some places just lockdowns and that's that. And, you know, just the shifts and ebbs and flows of it all. And there's artwork that is like emerging out of this, what will ultimately be like an era. Mm. And stuff that is like very poignant. And I don't mean this to be comparative at all. But like, for example, Bo Burnham's special Inside. And you know, something that, you know, he never mentions COVID, never mentions pandemic, but like there's so many emotions and feelings that everybody felt as a result of being inside and all that stuff. Like, I guess the question that I'm trying to kind of dig out here is like, were you writing this like in full awareness of like of that this is so this is so specific to this time and place that people who are living right now will feel so close to? Because I feel like the last year and a half has been, you know, aside from all the division that has arisen from this, at least in the first like 6 months of the pandemic, is probably the most collective the world has ever felt in a very, very long time. Mm. You know, like, was there a sense of that collectiveness in your work? Like, were you aware of that like almost everybody in the, at least in the Western world, was going through like everything you're writing about, pretty much? I mean, maybe not the diagnosis of your mother, but the sentiment of being inside and that experience.
Well, actually, so the year before pandemic, so 2019, I lived alone long distance from my family. So I was already kind of navigating this kind of isolation and loneliness of going through the world alone. And then the pandemic hit and I had to come back to Toronto just because of, you know, I didn't want to be far away from my family during such an uncertain time. And then and then my mom's diagnosis came. And so it really felt like I was going through my own journey up until it hit. And then once we all got into this collective place, it just felt like I had a head start on it almost. Like I had already been writing about being lonely and being isolated and being far away from people that I loved. So it just felt like a natural place to take the collection.
Right.
In like last summer, I guess, when I was really writing the bulk of it. But it definitely was something I thought about again in the editing process. Like, how do I make this relatable in a way that it's also timeless? Like, it doesn't only speak to isolation in a pandemic, but also speaks to isolation in a bigger world. Yeah.
Cause I think that the things that everyone has felt, a very large proportion of people have felt over the last 18 months is something that a lot of people experience all the time.
Yeah.
And now it's like everyone else has kind of been brought into the fold. I think that, you know, the experience of having depression and anxiety, I think you've got a much bigger swath of the population that's going, I understand how that feels on some level now. You know, I don't feel as if you're someone who's never experienced that before, you're probably thinking to yourself, I don't feel nearly as disconnected from that sentiment anymore for the people in my life that I maybe used to not really understand when they said that they were depressed or anxious, or, you know, they couldn't do this or they couldn't do that because they felt they were feeling, you know, they were feeling their symptoms coming on and they were dealing with that. And now you've got, you know, a way bigger understanding, I think, whether that's conscious or subconscious, of what it feels like to be there.
When did your struggles with depression begin?
High school. Yeah, definitely. I had a lot of struggles in high school. I actually ended up like bouncing around schools in the 11th grade because things were just not good. And I didn't want to go to school at all. And I was competitively dancing throughout that time. Just I did that growing up. And it was like really the only thing I wanted to do. And it was so clear that something was wrong because I only wanted to do this one thing that made me feel good. And I didn't want to partake in life otherwise.
Mm-hmm. At that point when you were going through that, did you know that it was depression, or is it sort of hindsight looking back?
No, it's hindsight. Definitely. My mom and I, like that, the original poem explaining my depression to my mom, I look back on those years as like the big inspiration for it, because it was just like, we just argued constantly. And I came from a family that was very like Italian, hard-headed, like you don't go to therapy, you just figure it out for yourself. And so that was a lot of my upbringing, was fighting it. And then it wasn't until I started sharing my work that I then got diagnosed, because I started telling the truth about how I was feeling, because I didn't feel shame around it anymore.
Favorite one-hit wonder,
or that overpriced toy your parents would never let you have,
or that TV show that no one else remembers because it was canceled way too soon. Now what if we could fix it? I'm Francesca Ramsey.
And I'm DeLon Grant. And after 20 years of friendship, we are now hosting a new nostalgia podcast called Let Me Fix It.
Each episode, we'll dig into our favorite celebrities, shows, and brands of yesteryear, and then imagine what it would take to repackage them for relevance today.
Think of our show as an intervention, but with way less stakes.
So subscribe to Let Me Fix It wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
It's interesting. I want to ask how you felt after you started talking about it. But I want to preface that question by quickly talking about this show on Netflix called Untold. There's an episode, it's this like docu-series about all these like wild and crazy sporting events. But there's one episode in particular about a tennis player named Marty Fish. And I won't spoil it, but he basically ended up going through severe... He was diagnosed with severe anxiety disorder, And at this tennis training camp when he was growing up and 15 years old, it was always about never presenting a weak image because your opponent will take advantage of that. People will not see you as being a talented athlete and so on and so on and so on. So this actually fed into this idea that he didn't want to ever tell anybody about the things that were going on in his head because he felt like that was a sign of weakness. And there was this really like profound moment in the show where he talked about the benefits of opening up. And when you start talking about it, how it starts to finally make you feel like you have this sort of control over this thing that has been controlling you. And I know for me, I messaged you guys last night and I mentioned that I had a bit of a rough day yesterday, but I feel like I've been in sort of a period of depression for the last little bit. And it's hard because you don't want to talk about it. You don't want to tell people because you feel like then you're burdening them with that thing that you're dealing with. But it is really interesting because when I texted you guys last night and said, I'm having a bit of a rough day, both of you guys sent me messages back and said like, hey, if you want to talk, we're here for you. And like, it feels good to know that you have a support system in place. And I guess like to come back to the question that I wanted to ask you is that when you started talking about it, did it really sort of make, you know, did you feel like that was the right decision in terms of how it made you feel being able to open up about what you were going through?
Oh yeah. When I started talking about it, I actually found out my own grandmother had been on antidepressants since she was in her 50s. And then my aunt was also in therapy and my cousin was in therapy and nobody in my family talked about it. And I was like, oh, okay. Yeah. We all deal with this and none of us are talking about this. Like now, not only do I feel closer, but I feel like way more comfortable discussing it because there's someone who gets it. And I really felt so alone before I spoke about it. And once I started talking about it, just the amount of people that were like, I actually feel that way too. When you could discuss it, it just makes you feel so relieved to be able to do that.
How did you find those things out about your family? Like who was the person that told you about that?
So my explaining my depression poem went viral and that's how everybody in my life found out I had depression. It was pretty wild, actually. I like had done the poem months earlier, didn't remember because I had a panic attack during the performance. And months later, the people who filmed it, Button Poetry, were like, oh, we really want to post this. And I was like, sure, I don't remember it. I'm sure it's fine if you want to post it. And then they posted it and everyone in my life was like, oh, you're, it put this thing around me where I was like, became this depression girl, which is like the person who talked about it. And it was so wild because it actually sent me into a depression spiral. Once everyone knew I had it, because then everyone wanted to talk to me about it. And it was like this thing I had been hiding for so long. And now it was like all that I was. And it was a very weird transition, to be honest.
Did it feel like you were, did it, in the sense that you found out that did you say it was your grandmother that you found out?
Yeah.
Like, did you get a sense that, that because this went, you know, not only public, but, you know, viral, the most public, that it like gave permission to anybody in your family to talk about, like, did anybody open up or was it like, you know, whisper, your grandmother was on antidepressants too, or was it more of an opening?
It was an opening for sure. She called me like crying when she saw the video and was like, I had no idea. I deal with this too. Let's talk about it.
And that's gotta be like, that's gotta be pretty challenging because that age group that is it, that generation is different. It's just a totally different ball
stigma
game.
Around.
There's just so much stigma around. My wife's grandfather is on antidepressants and has been on antidepressants for a few years and he doesn't know.
Whoa.
They didn't tell him because they knew he wouldn't take them.
So wait, What does he think he's taking?
I don't know.
Sugar pills.
I don't know. He's 90. That's wild. He's 96. So like, I don't know. I mean, I guess
he's probably got a few pills to take.
He's got
they're in his
he's
Monday,
got the,
Tuesday,
he's
Wednesday.
He's got the little pan of pills.
Sabrina, I wanted to ask, you said this event sort of spiraled you into a depressive episode, and everybody wanted to talk about it. And like, it's sort of before that I was talking about how talking about it makes you feel better. But it's interesting because when Taylor and Jer sent me a message last night to ask me if I wanted to talk about things, I didn't want to. But, you know, I felt like there was a difference between wanting to talk about it then in that moment and knowing that I have the option to do it, if that makes sense. Because I find that, like, you know, the tagline of our podcast for the first number of years that we started doing this was like, let's talk about it. And like, it was always about talking about illness and like talk about, and especially in terms of mental illness, like talk about things because it makes you feel better. And I believe that that's true, but I also believe that we only have a certain capacity to do that too. And sometimes talking about it actually can make it worse. And I think there's this very fine line from my perspective of like awareness of knowing that you can talk about it and it can help you feel better, but also maybe just not for a little bit too until you've had a chance to talk about things. Does that resonate with you?
Totally. The relief of knowing you can talk about it is sometimes enough. You don't actually have to talk about it. You just know that you can, and that's enough. And that came with sharing. But then having people come at me at times when I just didn't have the capacity to do that felt like a lot. And also it wasn't just people I knew, it was strangers as well. Yeah, so like having strangers come up to you and just like break every barrier known, just be like, hey, let's talk about that thing, that panic attack you had. It can be a little bit rattling when you were never a person who did that.
Did you get your diagnosis of, like, did you get an official diagnosis of depression before you did that poem in front of an audience of people?
No, it was actually afterward.
And was it after
much in the same period of doing the poem, but it was before the poem came out, but after I performed it in real life.
Okay. And so what was the process there? Was that like, did you do the poem and go, maybe I should talk to someone, you know, like, or did somebody else tell you like, hey, this is probably a good opportunity for you to go talk to someone because it seems like something's up?
So that poem took a long time to write. And I think during the writing of it, I was really in a bad depressive episode where I had one episode where I didn't leave my house for like a solid 10 days, I want to say. And that's when I called my mom and was like, hey, mom, we have to talk. Like, something's definitely wrong with me. Like, I'm afraid to leave the house. And that's when she was like, okay, you should probably come home for a bit. We should take you to the doctor. And that was the first conversation where that's what kind of spurred me getting the doctor's appointment. It was just like, okay, things are really bad. I'm like living alone and I can't.
And that experience of like having the conversation with the doctor, what was that like?
She was great, to be honest. I felt really comfortable talking. Like, I think it's important to have a doctor you like and you feel some kind of comfort with. And talking to her was great. She was like, okay, let's get you a therapist. Let's figure this all out and let's see if medication starts helping. And so I started a medication journey from that point forward.
And was that, did you find that to be helpful? Like the medication route was like something that was needed and worked out?
Yeah, I still take it. I find it really helpful. I think I was at a point where without medication, it would have taken so much longer to get to a functional place, where the medication just really helped kickstart that.
Mm-hmm. How do you relate? This is actually a question I asked pretty much the same question when we talked to Donna Morrissey a few weeks ago, who is a writer and was writing a memoir. How do you relate your struggles with mental health with like how your art comes through you in the way that there is, at least pop culture, there is this perception of like the tortured artist, you know, the alcohol or the depression or the whatever, you know, fill in the blank sort of fuels the like genius or the work and the beauty and everything. And then, which, you know, I mean, I guess in my personal opinion, looking at that from like an outside observance, I think like, oh, that fucking sucks, because that's something that is oftentimes like suffering. But like then I guess the view is that the suffering fuels this art. Like, how do you relate to that sentiment? Do you feel that, you know, the things that you go through are like the source of your art, or they are like or are they, you know, just like an aspect that works its way into your art because it just simply is a part of you?
Yeah, I think like I'm a depressed person, so the depression is like making its way into every poem I write, whether I'm trying to write about it or not. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like it's just there, it's present. Like that's my perspective. That's who I am. But I also think there's a level of like, what do I want to bring into my art? And I think I try really hard not to only bring misery into my work. Like I really try to bring in other emotions when I can. Mm-hmm. It's easy to write when I think part of me just gets obsessed with things, and that's what I write about. And it's easy to write about my own feelings because it's easy to get obsessed with like figuring yourself out. And so that's what I tend to, that's the kind of meat and potatoes of my work. But if something makes me feel good, I also want that to find its way onto the page as well. Like I don't only want to bring the like tortured artist to the page. I also want to bring the whole full spectrum of myself to it.
Yeah. Cause I always think about that whenever I read about an artist that, you know, produces this work, and then you kind of, you know, you do the deep dive on where the work comes from, what the writer or the artist or whatever is like as a person, what their life has been like. And I end up thinking to myself, like, I wonder if they don't want to get rid of whatever the thing is that society has sort of said fuels their work. And I'm always curious about like that. Like what, like, I mean, this kind of leads into a question of that we usually ask at the end of the, a sort of question that we ask at the end of every episode. But like, you know, if you could snap your fingers and get rid of depression and anxiety, would you?
I don't think I would. I think I like the view I have of the world. I've grown into it now. And I think that's part of it, is like caring about enough awareness of myself and other people to kind of go through life without burdening anyone with my own feelings. And I think that's a pretty good lesson that I've learned on how to navigate myself and the world and relationships.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that when, like, does your work, you know, you were saying earlier how after the poem went viral, where you were talking, about depression with your mother, that kind of sent you into a bit of a depressive state. Do you find that your work still to this day can have a negative effect on your mental health? Like for example, the release of this book, like as we're recording this, I think we're like 2 or 3 weeks out from the release date. Do you, you know, like leading up to those moments, like, are you riddled with anxiety? Is it challenging, like coming up to these milestones, or is this the kind of thing that like really fills your cup and makes you feel alive?
That's a great question. Yes, I'm extremely nervous. I think I've been in a little bit of a depressive episode just the last little bit as well. So I can relate to what you were saying. Like, you're just like, I don't know. Like, I think I'm going through one. And I think that doesn't have anything to do with it, but also does. So it's kind of hard to know, I guess.
Yeah.
The one thing I will say is this collection feels less revealing than the first collection, because I just know I have better boundaries about my writing. And like, I guess the best way to explain it would be like Drake said, this one's more of a tell some, not a tell all. Where the first one was definitely more of a tell-all. So I, as much as I'm anxious and nervous for it to be out in the world, I I don't feel like I'm giving away my whole self with this book, where the first one did feel a little bit more like that.
Yeah. Did you purposely set those boundaries, or was that something that naturally happened over the process of writing it?
Yeah, I absolutely set those boundaries. Mm. I think any relationship I have that's a current relationship in my life, I have to have boundaries on how I write about it, just to respect the other person.
Mm. Yeah. I was watching a show last night and one of the main characters is like really scholarly, and him and this other character are plotting this thing, and it's sort of like they set it into motion, and then they're actually sitting smoking a joint with each other afterwards, and they're just sitting there in silence, and they say to each other, one says to the other, there's nothing quite like the melancholy that appears when you are on the brink of a big success. And I was like, holy shit, I've never thought about that. But when I think about that, that's like rings really true. And it's sort of kind of like what we're talking about in essence right now in this conversation. And then the scene that follows was this man's daughter comes down into the kitchen and says, basically like, what's that smell? And he says, it's your father's old cigarettes. And he says, are you hungry? And she says, yes. And then there's like a 5-minute scene where it's just these two guys and this man's daughter. And it's just him making an omelet from like a zoomed out perspective. And it's like, I don't know. There was just something about the whole scene and how they set it up, but it was all based around this one phrase, like the melancholy that comes on the brink of a big success. And, yeah, I don't know. It just resonated with me. I don't know. Mm. I don't know. And it fits kind of perfectly in this mm-hmm. slot right here.
It's funny because that's a feeling that I know well, you know, like I feel like as much as I love my work, sometimes it's like the bane of my existence, you know, like if I'm about to do a big talk or something like that in front of a large audience, like it ages me, you know, leading up to that moment. Like it's, I don't think it's good for my health, but then when it's over, there's some sort of release that's quite euphoric.
But I think caring is just draining.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Like you care. That's
the saddest thing I've ever heard. Because it's so fucking true too.
You know, like you just care so much and then you're like, fuck, I'm just tired because I care so much.
That makes me want to not care about anything. I feel like I care about way too many things. Fuck my life.
What do you, what's on the horizon for you now, Sabrina?
I'm actually working on book 3.
Amazing.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask, because I have the feeling that we're getting close to wrapping, but I'm curious how your mom's doing.
Yeah.
Oh, she's good. She just had an appointment. She's a year cleared for no surgery. So we'll do another checkup in a year from now. Yeah.
Sweet.
Can you give me like the Coles notes on what an aneurysm is? Because I've heard the term so many times and I can never really remember exactly what goes on.
It's like something about the walls of the arteries. They're like weakening, and basically what happens is it could burst.
Right.
And if it bursts, you have a lot of issues.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, Sabrina, I got to say, this has been a real treat to sit down and talk to you. Again, the book is called I Love You, Call Me Back. It is on sale now. Where can people get their hands on the book? And also, how can people follow along with you and your work?
Yeah, so you can pretty much buy the book everywhere books are sold. But I would say go support your indie local bookstore if you can. And you can follow me along at badass_sab on most social medias.
Thank you so much for taking time out of your day today to sit down and chat with us. This has been really fun.
Yeah, it has.
Yeah, thank you. This is a pleasure.
That is it for today. Thank you so much, everybody, for tuning in.
If you like what you heard, make sure that you share our podcast with your friends. We love those extra ears.
Sick Boy Podcast is a Snack Labs production. It is produced by myself, Jeremy Saunders, Taylor McGilvery, Brian Stever, and Lauren Sankey. Sound design is coming to you from Donovan the Meerkat Morgan. The music of the show is from our friend Rich O'Coin. And Sick Boy Podcast is managed by Jeffrey Lonis. That is it for today.
I'm Brian.
I'm Taylor.
And I'm Jeremy, and this is Sick Boy.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.